Welcome to the Westside Investors Network, WIN, your community of investing knowledge for growth. This is the Real Estate Professionals Investing Podcast for real estate professionals by real estate professionals. This show is focused on the next step in your career, investing. Thank you for listening. And please, if you like our content, rate us on your podcast provider. Just a quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are for educational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any shares or securities, make or consider any investments or take any other action.
Welcome back to another episode of the Deal Deep Dive segment on the Westside Investors Network podcast. I'm your host, Trent Werner. In this segment, our featured guests will share their unique stories on a specific deal they've invested in. We will dive deep into finding the deal, financing the deal, writing an offer, and the due diligence. Do us a solid and smash that subscribe button, leave us a rating, and share this episode. And now, let's dive deep.
Welcome back to the Westside Investors Network podcast. I'm your host, Trent Werner. On today's Deal Deep Dive episode, we are joined by Ed Matthews, Park Street Capital. Ed's going to share about how his corporate career in Silicon Valley has translated into a successful real estate investing and syndication career. The deal we're talking about today is a 12-unit fire-burn building. Pretty much everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and I'm excited for you to hear about this 12-unit deal, as well as his first deal ever in real estate. Now let's welcome Ed Matthews. Welcome Ed Matthews with Clark Street Capital. He's joining us on the Deal Deep Dive today, and we're going to hear about kind of a treacherous deal. I promise that he can share a success story as well, but I love hearing about the treacherous deals that, you know, a lot of real estate investors unfortunately or fortunately go through during their career. Before we get into that, I want to hear about Ed Matthews, how you went from the 9-to-5 to the full-time real estate investor while all having a family and building Clark Street Capital. Ed, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Trent. I don't think I've ever worked a 9-to-5. I think I've always, 8-to-6, 8-to-8. You know, it's 5-to-10. It's probably why I do what I do now as opposed to what I used to do. So, Trent, thanks for the opportunity to be on the show. So I spent about a better part of 24 years working in corporate America in Silicon Valley for teeny tiny companies that a couple of them you may have heard of, but most of them probably not. And, I was traveling 150 nights a year, give or take. I was, diamond this and diamond that, and as far as hotel and airlines and all that, which is nice because I've got, a bazillion miles to now cook off, but earning them was rough. And, I'm a husband and a father of two young ladies. They were little and now they're much larger. And we, the first 10, 12 years of their lives, I was gone. And, I was missing all the really good stuff. I was missing the parent-teacher conferences and the choral concerts and the, swim meets and softball games and soccer games and just the really important stuff. Heck, dinner, with the family at the end of the day to see how things went. And, I got to a point where, and it was, I would love to tell you that I planned it this way, but it just kind of happened where my side hustle of buying little kind of crappy apartment buildings and fixing them up and making them clean and safe. And then ultimately upgrade them to the point where they were really nice. And then we'd flip a couple houses and do it again. And I did that rinse and repeat once a quarter for better part of 7 years. It kind of coincided with the fact that I was standing in a conference room with 2,000 of my colleagues at DocuSign. And Keith Kroc, who was the chairman and CEO at that point, who, if you know anything about Silicon Valley, he's one of the big hitters, right? And he, maybe even a Mount Rushmore kind of guy. And he was in front of of our team talking about 2018 and doing his laser light show and lighting the room on fire because, he's an incredible leader and a really charismatic guy. And I was standing there like, yep, Keith's right. I totally buy in, but man, I just don't have it in me to do this anymore. And I sat down with my wife. So that was right before the holidays, 2017. And I sat down with my wife and said, look, I think we're at the point where the portfolio is going to support us. And I'm missing too much stuff at home. I'm tired of being an absentee father. And so you know, we made the decision as a team to for me to resign, which I did, you know, as soon as we got back from the holidays. And February of 2018, I went headfirst and into Clark Street Capital. And we've been doing this full time ever since. And I, again, I don't think it's a 9-to-5 gig, but it's, you know, sometimes. And, but yeah, it's been 6 years and it's been wonderful. And we've, you know, predominantly focused on multifamily. Although it's funny, today's an interesting day because I got a niche to get back into flipping, and I might do that, but more as a, you know, nice way to generate some cash and have some fun because I love it. That's a blast. But, you know, long-term, our focus is on multifamily.
And so what was your portfolio? How many doors did you have when you felt like you were able to go full-time with real estate?
Let's see. When I left, we probably had about 130 doors. You know, we got to as many as 200, just short of that. Actually, I don't think we ever clipped 200. And actually, the company itself is going through a fairly substantial transition because I am in the process of selling off all of our New England assets. So we just got out of Vermont. That was like 60 units. And then we're selling off most of our Connecticut properties with the intent of, because they're all, you know, 4 units at the smallest to, you know, 15 units, I think, at the biggest. And so we're trading up. And so we're basically creating capital and 1031 exchanging into larger assets down in the Carolinas, which is literally in the middle of that process right now.
Awesome. So, and I guess what drove you to make that decision? Obviously, the Carolinas and the Sun Belt region are on fire right now. Was that the only deciding factor? Was there anything else pushing you to make that move?
So several factors. One is that I learned that that writing an LOI for a 125 unit building is the exact same process as writing one for a 10 unit building. It's the same process to raise capital for it. It's the same process to onboard it and the building and the residents. And, you know, if we're going to, you know, the goal ultimately is to grow to 1,000 units, and it's a lot easier to do it at 125 a unit or 125 a building as opposed to 10 units at a time. So it's a matter of just scale.
Makes sense. That makes sense.
And the other part of it is I'm older, right? So I'm 54 and I've got one girl and one daughter in college and another one who's a sophomore in high school. And as she progresses into college, you know, I think my wife and my life are probably going to move south anyway. So, that is, you know, North Carolina seems to be a good fit given the market conditions down there.
Absolutely. And aside from work ethic and tenacity, what was the big thing that you took from your corporate career that you've been able to roll over into real estate?
So, you know, the really cool part about the companies I worked for, and I worked for teeny tiny companies up to medium-sized companies. And I got to wear a lot of different hats, right? I got to be a marketing guy. I got to be a sales guy. I got to, you know, be an operations person. I got to run a couple of companies. And I learned a lot, right? And so I'm able to directly apply those lessons into my business today. And, you know, to kind of give you a range of things, you know, it's in terms of, you know, the operation and scaling it. So process and procedures, putting in enabling technology to, you know, I view technology as a force multiplier. And so, you know, we're able to operate at a much higher level than companies of similar size, mainly because, you know, we embrace technology and use it to create that, you know, variable 1+1=5 kind of scenario. So we're able to move very quickly. We're able to be very nimble. We're able to react. So that's part of it. If I learned anything in my Silicon Valley days, it's to have an action or a bias towards action. So I would rather fire and then aim and make a mistake and fix it than wait for a perfect scenario and which never arrives, by the way. And, you know, and you know, go slow. I'm just not built that way. So I'm a bit of a
coward. So you learned how to combat analysis paralysis through your corporate career, and now you've been able to roll that into real estate. That's awesome.
Pretty much. And it's, you know, it's interesting because it counters the way my brain is wired, because I, you know, I tend to think I'm not a technologist, but I, you know, I've never been an engineer, but my brain works that way. So I want to know as much about a scenario as humanly possible before we pull the trigger. So it's that constant balance of, do I know enough? Right.
So you said that you've done flipping. Obviously, we've talked about your current portfolio and the transition that you're going through. Yeah. flipping houses, you always hear stories about how the deal didn't work out or you opened up a wall and all of a sudden it was a can of worms. We're not going to talk about flipping today. We're going to talk about your multifamily properties, a couple of them. The first one we're going to talk about is a deal that had some hair on it, had some hurdles that arose from what it sounds like. What kind of deal are we talking about today?
We're talking about a 12,000 square foot, 12 unit multifamily. So my flipping days informed a lot of what I do today and what our team does in multifamily, in that, you know, when I tell people that we buy crappy apartment buildings from landlords who basically suck at their jobs, I really mean it, right? So when we go into a building, I don't care how bad it is because my guys can fix just about anything. And, you know, the only thing we can't fix is functional obsolescence. So we're always mindful of that. But, you know, if there's structural issues, if there are fire damage, if it's, which is what we're going to get into today, you know, pretty much any issue, I'm highly confident that, you know, our team is able to make the building clean and safe and then ultimately upgrade it to the point where, you know, people are proud to live there. And so short version of a very, very long story, now mindful of your time frame, is I bought a 5-unit in New Britain, Connecticut, which is a mid-sized city here in Connecticut. And I got a phone call from our property manager, and Cecilia called at 6 a.m., which if you've ever gotten a phone call at 6 a.m. from your property manager, it's never good news, ever, right? It's not, hey, all the residents paid their rent early this month, right? That's never the phone call. The phone call is, hey, we got to talk, right? And so my phone call was, have you seen the news? I was like, oh boy. And so she said, when you turn the news, she knew I was an early riser. And so it was like 5:45, 6 a.m. And she said, when you turn on the news, you're going to see your building on the news. And I need you to know what's going on. And I said, okay, which one? And it turns out the 5-unit that I bought 10 yards away was a 12,000 square foot building that was on fire that morning. And I didn't own that building at that point. But she just wanted me to know that she was on site. My building was fine. You know, all the folks that lived in our building were fine. But next door was, you know, a pretty big fire. And she just didn't want me to turn it on and hear Arch Street and go, oh my God, this is a problem. And so turns out that the person who owned that property wasn't very good at his job. And the building had been basically condemned for lack of management and a whole bunch of other issues around drugs and being sold and all that. And amazingly, the building got struck by lightning, you know, about a week later and went up, you know, in flames. So I go on site just to, you know, be present and make sure that, you know, our folks are okay. And if there's any questions, you know, it's better that they hear it from me rather than someone else. And so as soon as the fire department got the fire, you know, under control and put out, you know, I'm looking in there and one of my buddies is there and he's looking in there and he goes, doesn't look that bad. It's like it's the fire was central to or focused on one particular area of the building. The rest of the building was untouched. And so fast forward a couple of weeks, I have a structural engineer friend of mine who did me a favor. And I said, hey, Paul, can you come walk a building with me? And he arrived and I had big bolt cutters in my hand. And he's like, what are we doing? I said, shh, we're going to go in this building and we're going to go check it out. So ended up going in the building. I do not advise this because it was really, looking back on it, it was epically stupid. But nevertheless, we did this. And so we walked the building and realized that the flooring systems had been, you know, fire damaged on, you know, very specific areas on the left corner of the building. But everything else was relatively intact. So my buddy Ron is like, I can track this guy down if you want me to. I was like, yeah, let's see what he wants for it. And so structural engineer Paul signs off on it and says, this building can absolutely be saved. It's going to be expensive, but you can save it. So it depends on what we buy it for. Fast forward another couple of weeks, we track the guy down. He wants $1 bazillion for it. I offer him 10 grand for it, I think. And we landed at about $50,000. And, you know, immediately, you know, my responsibility is now the new owner, once we closed, was clean and safe. And so, you know, I hired a contractor to come in, somebody I'd worked with, you know, a couple times before. They were excellent. Comes in and, you know, just create security, you know, make the building secure. So board up all the windows, start cleaning out what can be cleaned out, stay away from the fire areas.
And now here's a word from our sponsor.
Get things done while you're on the move. Learn more about working with a virtual assistant through Offsite Professionals. It's a great way to get all the things done that you need to get done. Have freedom in your time and streamline your life by automating your business. Stop spending time on the tasks that you can delegate and start spending more time on your superpower. Call us today at 503-446-3177 or visit our website at offsiteprofessionals.com.
Uptown Syndication is now offering a syndication coaching program for you to take your real estate portfolio to the next level. This is your opportunity to have experienced syndicators, AJ and Chris Shepard, coach you on your way to controlling your real estate investing future. Our coaching program will provide you with the tools and framework needed to begin syndicating real estate in your target market. Go to uptownsyndication.com today to learn more.
And the fourth floor was probably it was a four-story building. Fourth floor was the most damaged because obviously fire burns up. And the decking, all the rafters and all of the, you know, the flooring for or the decking for the roof are completely toast, literally. And so I told the contractor, okay, here's our scope. I want you to remove the rafters and the decking, leave everything else because everything else is support. You know, this was a big brick building built in like 1890. And the way that buildings like that work is it's by tension, right? So the cross beams that run the length of these buildings are designed to push on the walls because the walls want to push in. And basically it creates tension so that the building doesn't collapse on itself, right? And so here's where I made the mistake. So I had vetted this contractor three ways to Sunday. I mean, I talked to half a dozen, maybe even more, other investors that this guy had worked with, and he raving reviews. He was just a really solid guy, and he hired a subcontractor to come in and do the demo of the roof, and the subcontractor brought in his son and some other kid who I never found out about. I never found who he was. And instead of just taking out the decking and the burnt out, the gaitered rafters, you know, the burnt out rafters, they cleared the entire fourth floor of wood, everything, support, everything. So I basically had a brick box. Less the contractor calls and says, hey, we got a problem. I'm fixing it. I'm on it. And, you know, my bad, because I should have paid attention to this, but I trusted the sub to watch his own guys while I was, you know, he was on floors 1, 2, and 3 doing his part. And, you know, turns out that the guy that was the sub was not monitoring or supervising his guys. So he just said, clear the floor, and they did what he said. And so I said, all right, so what's the plan? He said, you know, we're going to stabilize it as best we can tomorrow. Right now, you know, it was the end of the day. And so I was like, all right, I have to go to New York for a business meeting. So I'm on my way to New York. I get a phone call. Hey, bad news. Okay. What happened? The back wall, which was 50 feet, 3 courses of brick, 18 feet tall, the entire back wall went into the back parking lot. And I said, okay, first question, anybody hurt? Nope, everybody was fine. I said, okay, is anybody in the building right now? No, everybody's out. Good, keep it that way. And so as luck would have it, the bricks had fallen into the 4 dumpsters that we had in the backyard and the back parking lot. So it actually helped us, you know, in terms of cleanup, although I really would have preferred to just keep the wall. But so I get a phone call later that evening. Hey, bad news, front wall just fell in. And I said, okay, well, that is over a sidewalk and over the street. Again, anybody hurt? Nope, fell into the building, not out of the building. Okay, so what's the damage? He said, every rafter, all 38 joists on that third floor ceiling are all broken because the front end of that wall was 50 feet, 22 feet tall, 3 courses of brick. So, you know, I mean, you're talking thousands of pounds. Mm. And I'm on my way back. So, you know, immediately I head back towards New Britain. And it, you know, basically had effectively collapsed a 12,000 square foot building because by the time I got there, You know, the building official was on site. The fire captain was on site. The mayor was on site. And 20 other people, I don't remember who they were. And so, you know, I assured them, I said, look, we're going to fix this. We're going to figure it out. Structural engineer comes and says, it's amazing as it sounds, this is salvageable. You know, you've got to, we were going to replace the flooring systems anyway. So the fact that the rafters were broken, not the end of the world, but, you know, the problem is, you know, Les, the contractor, to his credit, standing right there next to me, which most guys would have head for the hills, like his subcontractor did. I never talked to him ever again. He evaporated. And so again, we stabilized the building from third floor down and ultimately made the decision to not continue with the project. And we bulldozed the building. So, you know, the huge mistake I made was not vetting the sub, right? You know, we go through an arduous process. It's not easy to do business with us purposefully, right? You know, we go through your insurance. We go through, make sure you, not only do you have insurance, but do you have the correct insurance? You know, we go through your ability to you know, handle the size of the project that we're handing off, you know, from a financial perspective. I mean, it's a arduous process, a very rigorous process to go through. The mistake I made that day, which I've never made ever again, is I didn't do the same thing with the subs. And turns out this guy was, you know, well-intentioned, but inexperienced. He didn't have the right insurance and he didn't have the expertise nor the management skills to be able to do what was supposed to be done. So effectively, by that oversight, I collapsed a 12,000 square foot building, which ultimately I ended up selling the project for a very tidy sum that, you know, first step is sue everybody, right? And try and get it through, fixing it through insurance. Insurance didn't want to pay. So ultimately we went to court and ultimately we got it resolved. So I, you know, got pretty close to even, And then a developer came in and bought the land from me for, you know, a very more than fair price. And in the long and the short of it is I spent about $350,000 of my own money to protect my investors to make sure that they didn't lose their shirts. You know, so basically I was stabling the building and I got reimbursed for that. So $350,000, part of it was just buying the investors out. Part of it was stabilizing the building. And ultimately, I got that money back and a little more. So, you know, I didn't lose my shirt. Although the other part of it is that happened right before COVID hit and it didn't get adjudicated until after COVID was resolved. So that 22 months or so is very stressful. But, you know, long story short, it worked out. Everybody's happy. No one got hurt. Everybody got paid. And I made a little extra money on it. So I guess the lesson is vet every single human being that walks on one of your construction projects and don't make that mistake. So I made that mistake in 2019 and I'm way smarter today in 2024.
I was going to say, I bet you never make that one again.
Nope.
So Ed, when you bought this building, I think you said you paid $50,000 for it. What was do you remember what the construction budget was to get all the fire damage and everything back up and running initially?
Yeah, it was about $800,000 if memory serves. Yeah.
And what was your projected ARV after doing all that work?
$2.2 million.
Okay. So if the deal, if the deal worked out the way you intended, it would have been a great deal. And you took a very unfortunate circumstance and you actually, you know, you salvaged it and made what you could out of it. So I think that's another lesson here in this story is, the deal went as far south as you could go. But, you know, you were still able to figure out a way to, again, make the investors whole and save the deal the best you could.
Yeah. And, you know, every bad thing that could happen other than somebody getting hurt, thankfully, no one was ever hurt. Every single other thing that could have gone wrong went wrong on that project. So it was Murphy's Law was working overtime those months.
So we talked about the bad deal. I promised you could talk about a successful one. So we heard about, I mean, honestly, that might be the craziest bad deal we've ever heard on this show, because like you said, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. What's the successful deal that we're going to talk about real quick?
First deal I ever bought. So I read Rich Dad Poor Dad in 2008, and it fundamentally changed my perspective on a whole lot of things, specifically that I was going to be my own boss at some point in my life. And real estate was going to be my vehicle because I had always had an affinity towards real estate anyway. And this, you know, reading that book's like, cinched it. I'm doing it. And it took me 3 years to get the courage to pull the trigger on a deal. And when I finally thought I was ready, I met this broker, Amy Rio, God bless her. And at that point in her career, she was probably, you know, running a 4 or 5 agent office. And, you know, she was tiny. And for whatever reason, I don't know if she took pity on me or saw something in me or whatever, but that woman showed me no less than 20 properties. And, you know, this was late 2010. And, you know, back then, if you recall, you could wet a towel and shake it over your head and hit, you know, a dozen really good deals. It was a target rich environment. And mm-hmm. I was, no, I don't want a white one. No, I don't want a blue building. No, that one needs a roof. No, that one needs windows. I was coming up with every dumb excuse not to pull the trigger. And really that they all equated to, I was terrified of taking on that responsibility. And so we get to Clark Street, and hence the name of my company, 1115 Clark Street. And we walk the, you know, it was a 4-unit. It was a foreclosure. Person who was redoing it ran out of money, left the keys on the counter, and I scooped it up from the bank. But I, you know, as we're coming, we walk through it. It's in really good shape. It's almost finished. And, you know, we're coming out the back stairs and out onto the parking lot out back. And I'm already, you know, coming up with my 14 excuses as to why I'm not going to buy this building. And Amy, Amy is generously, she's 5'1" and I'm like 6'4", 6'5", right? So I'm like a foot and a half taller than this woman. And I tell you that because she is listening to all my excuses and she goes, yep, I've heard that one before. Yep, understood. Takes out a piece of paper and puts it on the hood of my truck. And she's nodding and I'm going on and on about, you know, the 14 reasons why I can't possibly buy this building. And she takes out a pen and clicks it. And she's like, all right, stop. She goes, look, I like you. If you don't buy this property, I'm going to buy it because it's the best deal I've shown you yet. Now, and she said, you know, I've shown you 20 properties. And if you don't buy this, or if you don't sign this effing contract, she didn't say effing, I am never talking to you ever again. And go pound sand. I'm ignoring you. I can't do this anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was a point where I was more afraid of Amy, who I'm a foot taller than, right, than I was of signing the contract. And I took the pen and said, yes, ma'am, and signed the contract. And honestly, it was one of the best deals I ever did. And I thank her. Now she is one of the biggest brokers in the state of Connecticut. She's got hundreds of agents. And, you know, where I used to see her, you know, once a week, now I see her probably once a quarter because, you know, she's big time now. So, you know, I bought that property for $99,000. Rehab lasted about 3, almost 4 weeks. We got it running and leased in a matter of 5 or 6 weeks. And it's been cash flow positive since that day. I've never lost a penny from on a month-to-month basis ever on that building. And this Friday, I'm selling it for $420,000. And so, you know, relatively speaking, not a huge win. I'd call it a double, might stretch it into a triple. But, you know, the fact that I 4X'd my money in, you know, 10 years, 12 years, and enjoyed a lot of cash flow out of that building over the course of that time, I would say it's, you know, a big win in that respect. But it was also a big win because it got me started, right? Mm-hmm. Those first 4 units turned into 200 units over the course of, you know, a few years. And, you know, gave me the courage to push forward. And, you know, I look back at that version of me in 2011, when I finally closed on it, versus what I am today. I mean, I'm the guy who walks into a fire-burned building and goes, yeah, we can fix that, right? And that was not the guy that signed the contract on that, the purchase and sale on that first deal on Clark Street. So, yeah, it's been a nice ride.
I was going to say the monetary side, the rewards that you've gotten from that deal outweigh the money compensation and the financial 100%. Compensation 100x. It sounds like from what you're telling me. I mean, it was a good deal, but what it's done for your career and Clark Street Capital, I think outweigh every bit of that one deal itself.
That 99K made me millions.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure. Yep.
Awesome, Ed. Did I miss asking you anything? Did you want to share anything else today?
Well, if you want to hear about any more of these deals, I have our own podcast. It's the Real Estate Underground. And if you want to listen in, I interview really accomplished real estate investors from all asset classes. And, you know, my goal is to pick a gold nugget from them, at least one during every call, every show. And I'm usually successful in pulling out a few. And so it's a nice educational format, and it's a whole lot of fun. So I welcome you to listen if you'd like.
And are you on social media or website or anything like that?
We're everywhere. So we're Clark Street Capital on pretty much every social media platform. And I'm Ed Matthews with one T pretty much on all social media platforms. And you can find more about our company at clarkst.com.
Awesome. And I highly encourage everyone listening to go check out Ed's podcast as well as his website. He has a wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure his guests are equally as awesome as he was today. Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure thing, Trent.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Real Estate Professionals Investing Podcast on WIN, your community of investing knowledge for growth. We hope that this episode has increased your knowledge and added value to your path to freedom. If you would, please take a second to rate us so that we can get more great investors to interview. If you or someone that you know wants to be on, please visit westsideinvestors.com and fill out our form to be on the show. Thank you again and enjoy your day.